Thank you, Brian.
I'd like to say before I get started here, I'm going to be the kickoff for our presentation, followed by my colleague Sally Black, Dave White, Sally Black. We get a lot of laughs over that, so it's not purposeful, it's just the way it is. And also, I would like to say that Kelly Welsh was also played a part in this. She's with Child, and so she was unable to make it. But she's with our external communication at St. Joe's University, where Sally and I teach. Okay. So actually, what Marie and Dan had to say was a good segue into what I'm going to talk about. So if you'll allow me to basically kind of set the parameters for what Sally is going to pick up on in a second. But one of the things I became fascinated with I teach health policy, and I have for a number of years at St. Joe's, 21 now and counting. But one of the things that I think we're all aware of, the excesses of the radical right are pretty well known to everybody, except those who are ideologically sympathetic or clueless. And they are things like, attracted to mass murders, Charlie Manson, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, that sort of thing. But I think what is also very frightening to me as a public health type of person and an academic is the fact that the attack from the radical right on science and reason has really been egregious in the last 10, 15 years. And so one of the things we wanted to talk a little bit about today, sadly, if I could spend the entire 10:30 to 12 o'clock talking about examples of this, so I'm going to hit some of the highlights. And once I've done that, Sally is actually going to talk about strategies, which dovetail very nicely with what Marie and Dan were talking about. So just in a way, I'd like to set the tone by talking about the fact that much of this, if you've been paying attention to the media, which both the previous speakers talked about, you'll note that oftentimes we have certain venues. Fox News is probably the best example, where just about anything that you hear, it runs. If you fact check it on Google fact check, you'll find out it's patently not true. Probably the best examples are the denial of empirical evidence regarding smoking and ill health, selection of 300 conservative judges. This happened under the Bush administration. Denial of global warming. I just had this conversation with somebody the other day. Interestingly, I was reading an article about how the polar caps are melting at an advanced range, and my wife and I were in Patagonia about 5 years ago. We went because we wanted to get there before the ice is all gone. Yet there are people walking around who are denying this is happening. So we also, looking at the research, one of the things that I was struck with was the amount. It's actually, you have handouts, Sal, if you want to pass them around. I made a purpose effort to actually give you data. And so if you think something I'm saying is unsupported, there's an extensive bibliography that you could check out with regard to a lot of the assertions I'm making. But the EPA, under the former administration, was renowned for actually setting us back in terms of the public health agenda, particularly with things like emissions, pollutants and emissions. So this is a litany of some of the other things that we hear all the time, the advocacy of creationism and intelligent design versus evolution, the insistence of absence-only education in spite of the woeful track record it has. As a matter of fact, Sarah Palin was one of my favorites who talked about abstinence-only education. Her own daughter was pregnant, so that tells you something about how well it works. George Will, who's one of my least favorite people, called the National Association of Social Work Code of Ethics, and incidentally, I have to say that I am a social worker, one of the things I do, and he called it a surreptitious political agenda, and our schools of social work as schools of indoctrination. And having gone to school in the 70s in social work, I'm not quite sure where George is coming from. Also, there's overwhelming evidence of unprepared leadership of the Food and Drug Administration, and inspector generals at NASA who did not do what they were intended to do. We teach at a Catholic university, so this is my own belief, certainly not the university's perhaps, but literal interpretations of the Bible to push ideological agenda. The biggest bit right now, of course, is abortion. I'm so afraid that the healthcare reform is going to be basically set aside on the cause of the fight over abortion, which is just absolutely maddening to me. So it seems like we ought to be able to put this in context. Conservative beliefs cloaked as moral superiority and the blockage of embryonic stem cell research. Finally, Nancy Reagan came to bat, of course, because her husband had Alzheimer's. It seems like it takes a tragedy in your own family in order for you to see the potential of something like this. More recently, and these things just happened within the last few months, which I think are really sad, the Republican Party actually sent out a letter saying that national health care reform would deny Republicans the ability to get health care. This is an actual fact that's been checked on Fact Check. It's also been reported in the mainstream press, and the GOP actually has never really denied sending out the letter. Obviously, it was a fundraiser. More recently, with Obama's speech to school kids, which I have to say, since I've been on the planet, which has been quite a while, almost every president does this, and yet it was considered a political agenda. People pulled their kids out of school. The other thing that really drove me nuts, my wife and I were watching the joint session of Congress when Joe Wilson screamed liar at the president, which I thought was a little over the top. Now, why this matters so much is it's almost like anything Obama, and I don't agree with everything the president does, but certainly it's disingenuous to basically to frame things the way they're being framed, particularly in the sound science, and we are, as Marie just said, we're supposed to be reaching out, and we have a public health agenda, not a political agenda. I think, unfortunately, it's being skewed. One of the other interesting things that I ran into, and again, it's in the bibliography, is that the radical right, the GOP leadership, being on the same page on a message. There are a number of front groups that these so-called town meetings that you keep hearing about with the Patriots, almost every one of those groups that's being seen on television and reported in the press are basically created by the GOP, and they're funded by people like Dick Armey, the former representative from Texas, the Scaife family in Pittsburgh, which is a real right-wing family that tried to bring the Clintons down. So if you look into the titles of these, Google them, you'll find that many of these front groups are not at all, they're not grassroots things. They're actually being the way of pulling in the folks that the GOP's trumpeting. And sadly, the GOP leadership is on message. So you'll see them on TV, like John Bonner from Ohio, or Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, and they're using the same words, like the death panels, the big thing about incentivizing healthcare providers to talk about end-of-life decisions being talked about euthanasia, the slippery slope of euthanasia. So that's out of the bill too, as you probably are aware. So one of the other things, I get a newsletter from something called it's called Tolerance, and it's from the Southern Poverty Leadership Group. And I don't know if anybody here is aware of Morris Daisy. Does great stuff on civil rights. He does great stuff on social justice. And he's pointed out that there's been a real military frenzy lately. There's been an increase in all kinds of violence. But anything that has to do with Obama, whether it's a public health thing, the national health reform bill, everything is framed as somehow he's got this communistic agenda and everything's evil, which I think is really unfortunate. As I said just a few weeks ago in a panel we had at St. Joe's on healthcare reform, you can disagree, but disagree to disagree, and at least be genuine in your concern. If you have a concern like abortion, for instance, or if you have a concern about free market, as Marie just said, then let's have a discussion about that, but let's not skew the information, and that's one of the things Sally is going to talk about. Rochelle DiComaro, just a few months back in the American Journal of Public Health, talked about one of the best things to do to counter a lot of this is use the judicious application of trusted knowledge. And she was talking about how, sort of what Dan was saying, that the media is very helpful, but let's look at consensus around things like global warming. So if the experts tend to agree on certain things, let's hang our hat on that. He also talks about being vigilant about what they call misleading alchemy in terms of epidemiological studies. I don't know if you saw as well, just recently, there's much to do of the fact that a lot of the large pharmaceutical companies in the country, Merck, Pfizer, et cetera, have used ghostwriters for academic, so-called academic research. So they're actually paying academics to put their name on research that's being done by the company to push a particular drug. And of course, my other favorite is off-marketing, which is basically using a drug for something they never had clinical trials for. And I think all these things are issues that public health practitioners really need to step up to the plate and make sure people understand. So at this point, I'll ask my colleague to please give you the strategies. Thank you.
I work in youth violence prevention, specifically bullying prevention. I'm going to spell that U-L-L-Y-I-N-G because usually when I say bullying, I don't know, my Philadelphia accent, people say bowling. But as you can probably have seen in the last couple of years, in youth violence prevention, we have really done a little bit of a turnaround in bullying prevention. And we went from zero tolerance, where you beat kids to teach them not to bully each other, to now opening the door and understanding that there are other problems that are causing kids to bully each other. And really, the school shootings got us to that point, and really increased awareness of bullying in the news, because if a kid is that desperate that they feel they need to take a gun to school to stop bullying, then, you know, it means that the adults are not doing their job. So we've really come a long way, and part of that has been by working with the media. So what I'm going to present to you today is really just stuff that I learned. It's not from a research study, and it's not from years of experience. So I would welcome the experts stepping in. And what I've learned by working with Kelly Welsh is that not only does the media play a major role in influencing how people think about issues, their attitudes towards issues, and then the actual behaviors of school administrators in stopping bullying, but also the public is a consumer of that information, so the public will also drive what the media talks about. So it's really a reciprocal relationship. And the way that the media influences the audience is, that reciprocal relationship works is the characteristics of the audience. Are they ready for change? Now, in bullying, that was kind of forced forward. We didn't have to go through the regular stages of change model. How complex is the issue? Are people going to be able to understand it? And then what are the ambiguous messages that are out there? Now, for bullying, it was the long-term, what we've all been raised with. Fight back. And then the frequency and degree of exposure are going to impact the messages. The types of influence on the audience, there's immediate learning. Don't always hang your hat on immediate learning. You probably won't get it. There's going to be delayed learning where you can actually just plant a seed that can be taken up later on by people. Generalized learning, people are just to persuade attitudes. And then social diffusion. It was interesting. I was just at a meeting yesterday with a group, a community that we're trying to get into in terms of increasing awareness of children's exposure to domestic violence. And as you can imagine, most communities do not want to admit that there's domestic violence within their community, and they don't want to talk about it. But the people from the community noted that with Chris Brown, the recent incidents with Chris Brown, all of a sudden this is stimulating social discussion, and this is something that the community wants to talk about because they're no longer looking at themselves, they're looking at, you know, how could this have happened? And then institutional diffusion. We're seeing this with the flu pandemic. Before, you were sick, your boss expected you to go to work. Now they're telling you to stay home. So we can start to influence on all these different levels. And it's important to work with the media to make this influence. What we can start to do in setting an agenda is to talk about what's going to be covered, what people think about the issues, and then hopefully we can influence legislation. So this is a really, really powerful tool, and I would very much encourage you to work with the media. I know none of us, as Dan said, want to see our face in the media or want to hear our voice,
but this is the only way we're going to get the messages out there, or the best way to get the messages out there. The media doesn't actually tell people what to think about an issue. It tells them what to think about, because they see this information over and over again. It helps to frame how to look at an issue, and then, as I said, obviously to encourage legislation. Now, these are the lessons that I've learned. The first one is read the newspaper, look at your local news daily. See what the issues are. And then as soon as an issue hits the news, contact reporters. Make this a teachable moment for people. Okay? There's a lot that just jump right on that bandwagon and try to get the correct information out there. Talk to your reporters. Talk about how to frame the issue. If they're interviewing you and they start to kind of go in the wrong direction, then redirect them back into the way that you would like them to go. Don't try to get everything out there. Just give them small chunks of information, very simple pieces of information. You might disagree with that. But I think that that's much more successful in getting people where they need to be. Don't expect or don't try to make major changes in attitudes or behaviors. Just take baby steps, and that will eventually get you where you need to go. If you can give them stories, if you can give them case studies, use those, because that's what really helps people to understand. In bullying, I have tons and tons of stories that we can talk about to help the media understand what's going on. Sound bites, really good little phrases, tend to make a larger impact. And then repetition is the mother of learning. You know, this is like working with your teenage kids or with your kids. You're going to have to tell them 100 times to pick up their clothes off the floor, okay? But eventually they will get it. That's all I have. Questions?
Okay, we just have about 10 minutes then for our Q&A for any of our remaining speakers. Yes?
This is a question, but a request that we're holding on to the handouts passing around.
Okay, where's the stack of handouts? Or are we out of handouts?
I do have a PowerPoint, so I'll put them up here.
Okay.
Thanks.
Are they gone? They may be gone.
They're gone.
Okay.
Another question, and this is for our news guy up in front.
Yes.
Understanding that hopefully all local health agencies need to build relationships with their local media. Do you think, in your experience, it's more effective for a health agency to feed stories, trying to put in the importance of the cover of this aspect or that, or simply asking reporters, what stories do you think are you covering that you want us to be a part of? I mean, we need to control the message so the messages don't get skewed, but which aspect do you recommend?
I think your second suggestion is really an interesting one, because it's showing empathy from where they're coming from and also showing respect for their opinion. It's all right to pitch things too, but be careful about not overdoing it, about things that truly are not relevant. Remember, what they're interested in is, there may be background public health events that have been around forever, but they don't really rise to the level of a news story because of their old hat, and unless there's something new to that, chances are it's going to be awfully hard, even if you have unless you're a feature writer, by the way, and don't dismiss the importance of a feature writer, because they can get a lot of useful information too. And the way the newspapers are going in this country, the Sunday paper is going to be it, folks. We're going to have, we got some major papers already going down to Thursday and Wednesday publications when food ads are out, and then the Sunday paper. I think we're going to see more of that, and that would be the paper that is, as I think most people use it now, it sticks around all week. And so that's a chance to get those stories in. But yes, get to know them. Read bylines. When the suggestion just given here by Sally about being familiar with the local press, that's not just the reputation of the publication or the broadcaster, but actually pay attention to the bylines and the people on the air. Who do you respect? Who do you think consistently gets it right or shares an interest in the topics that you're in? They get an awful lot to land. So if you're on the phone every day or even every month, maybe too much, they're constantly on board, and usually there's a hidden agenda. Reporters say, there's something important here. You know, I mean, the information exposure is a valuable commodity. You know, I mean, people pay a lot of money for that airtime.
When you were talking, some of the countries that you had listed in your data, they're in the Navy, which struck me, since we know they have such a great human rights record. Does that affect the message from the government? The fact that the government is, Indonesia, I mean, it's military run. Are the people less likely to buy whatever they hear if the government tends to be unfriendly?
Well, I can't answer completely then, because I don't know exactly what the attitude of the public is completely towards their government or their public health institutions. But I will say that they are drawn. They are motivated by a lot of the same things that motivate us. If there's an acute emergency, you get their attention very quickly. And there would be, they can be helpful in helping put that to rest. Now, one of the big political issues in Indonesia has been a rather kind of a crazy minister of health that, is trying to drive a wedge between that country and everybody else, especially ours, with respect to virus sharing. We're not going to give our viruses to the WHO. They're going to go to Atlanta. They're going to make a vaccine for them, and then we're not going to get it. So they're exploiting our situation. And actually, the good part, there's a good thing buried in that, too. It has raised sensitivity to what is the role of providing reasonable access to vaccines to developing countries. And in the H1N1 distribution scheme, WHO has managed to get all the developed countries to, I don't know if they've all agreed, but we have, the United States has 10% of our vaccine to be distributed internationally by others. So we're doing that. But it's still the issue with Indonesia has been, I think more press briefly, how bold are the reporters going to be. Public health is a good place to start for them, too, because it's not as controversial as a rule. You know, it's one thing that they're bashing, because of something else the government's doing. Or corruption, which is always fair game. I think reporters are already, but can get you in jail in the wrong places. Generally, public health people, they may be incompetent, but they're usually not correct at least in the scientific level. The political machinery can screw things up because they haven't found it in other places. So reporters have to tread lightly, but when we're selling a public health message, usually that's pretty easy. Well, you pick your battles for one thing. You can't address every single one of those. But again, part of being actively involved in communication surveillance is to have an ear out for that kind of thing. Repetition is the mother of, you say it again and again. I mean, former CDC director was very good at this. Because, this issue is raised in vaccine safety. It's not just worrying whether or not vaccines can get put to us. It's Iowa. It's everywhere. And, these diseases are reappearing, and often the issue is that it's the bad old government trying to force doing vaccines now. Julie said it very well, it's we love children, we've got ourselves. We're not going to do anything to harm a child. And if you say that convincingly, you're not going to cut through everybody, but you get to someone. And when these diseases begin to resurface, and you begin to see that there is a price to pay by not taking advantage of the science to give us. And vaccines are an extremely valuable tool. We know they're safe. We know they prevent diseases. We become victims of our own success, and that today's generations of parents don't know what those diseases look like. And so it's easy. They want to do the right thing by their child, too. And that's part of the process of not saying, you're a bad mother because you're, not vaccinating your child. That's not a good message. They want to have good mothers. They want what's best for their kids. And I'm saying mothers because typically the women who make these decisions. You sit down with them and you reason it out. And you're not going to get everybody out there. And sometimes it's like with alcoholism. Sometimes you have to be a first blow. I hope we don't have huge outbreaks of pertussis in this country before we wake up to the fact that that disease is what it is. Shot doesn't, but the disease does.
Chris, back to you. So not only are newspapers closing, 24 out of 25 biggest newspapers declined in readership, but younger demographics aren't reading the newspapers.
4:30 don't follow the board's values, period.
Couple things. First of all, someone is writing for the internet sources that young people are going to. So there's still journalists at work. I think the biggest problem is the business model, and that's not my business. I don't have to figure out how they're going to make money doing it. But young people are getting news. They're just going to unmoored sources. They're also going to blogs and social media for information. That's a bit problematic because you can't always attest to the credibility of those information sources. And CDC is playing around in that area. We've done some things with Second Life and you know, Twitter and all that stuff. I'm not involved in that personally. There's limitations to each of those things. You know, on Twitter, you only get 150 characters. So it's hard to do that. And when you're talking about effective behavior change, yeah, oftentimes you can't expect a rapid change behavior, except if the fire alarm goes off, there will be a rapid behavior change, I can promise you. I mean, if there's an acute threat, people will respond to it, and that is a form of communication, too. And it does work, but for the most stuff, you know, it does fall by my eye. I've heard it many times.
What's your impression as a former newsman with that hand on of how much health and science journalists today are using, are relying on blogs from public health-related agencies to get quotes or get some bits and pieces of information? And from a school of public health, and we're thinking, oh, should we jump in? Should we not? Is a blog kind of a teenage freelance journalist kind of thing, or should we portray ourselves as like a credible source of public health information in a blog in addition to our press release?
Well, I would say the latter. I mean, I think a blog is, this is just my opinion, but I think if that becomes a vehicle that people are going to begin to use and to share, in the evolution of understanding, by participating in that, you're getting, as you used to say, you're getting your sticks in, you're getting your tripod set, you're getting to the front of the room and being able to influence that in a positive way. People need credible information, and if you are a credible source, go where they are, as long as you're not being used inappropriately in the process. And I think that's a caveat, because years ago I did some cancer stories on fire in Texas and Houston, and there was toying with the FDA to get his treatment authorized for clinical trials. So the reason he has about the clinical trials is that FDA won't review the studies. And they didn't because there was absolutely no shred of evidence at all. This was handy in plastic. But have you ever heard of that? Handy in plastic? Are you from Texas?
No, but I have a girlfriend who's been looking into
the person. I don't know if the guy still on Brzezinski's name. I'll forget. I'll remember him forever. But he taunted the FDA to, you know, finally they said, all right, run your trial. He never ran the trial. But was able to trade, I've got authority, I've got FDA on my side now. And added a layer of legitimacy to what he was trying to force into. I mean, this probably didn't do any harm. It wasn't very pleasant. His data was derived from urine, as I recall. And when you ran it into his lab, it smelled like it. But again, there's an example where we can tie it to the wrong vehicle. It can be used or exploited. CDC's name is extremely important. We wouldn't want to be tied to the wrong blog or the wrong situation. But we blog ourselves.
Well, thank you all. Thank you for our speakers.